you doing that. I'm an introvert, so I know how intimidating it can be sometimes to get up and do that. But thank you for putting forth the effort. May you get another crown in your jewel, or another jewel in your crown. I'm not so good at speaking either. One of the words that I think has probably been misused, or should I say maybe overused in our culture, particularly here in the South, is the word revival. I think you can drive down a southern road and you can pass any number of churches that would have on their sign revival, and you'll see the dates of the revival. And if you are new to the faith, you say, "What's a revival?" And what that usually means is that they're having a guest speaker from out of state, and he's going to preach his best sermons for a few days and to see if anything happens. But in the Bible, revival was a really important word. In Psalm 85, 6, the psalmist says, "Lord, wilt thou revive us again?" And when the psalmist wrote those words, he was writing from the context of a nation that had been defeated. He was writing of a people that had gone into captivity, that had returned to a place that was desolate. And as he looked at his situation, he saw that vitality needed to return, strength needed to return, the presence of God in his fullness needed to be in the midst of his people. And so he cried out, "Lord, revive us. Wilt thou revive us again?" There are times when a nation needs a revival. There's times when a nation has lost its vitality, it's lost its spiritual strength, it's lost its way. At those times, a revival from God is oftentimes only the only cure that can return the nation to its former glory. There are times when a church needs a revival. There are times in the life of a people of God that the vitality is lost, that there's a spiritual deadness among the people, that all the spiritual disciplines seem to come hard. It seems like praying is hard and worship is hard and people are angry at each other and preferences seem to govern the life of the people, and people argue about frivolous things, and the presence of God is far, seems to be distant in the midst of the people. At those times, revival is needed. And then there are other times when, as a person, as an individual, we stand in need of revival. We know the vitality is gone. We know that something is missing. We know that when we pray, it seems like heaven's way up there and we're way down here. We know that the Bible lays in our house and it's work to pick it up to read it. The vitality again is gone. And in those times, we need a personal revival. I want to read to you a passage of scripture that is really about revival. It's about a king, a young king who comes to the throne of Judah, and he looks around and he sees all kinds of problems in his kingdom. And something inside of him says, "This place needs revival." And he set about to bring about or to instigate revival among his people. And this is what the Bible says he did. In verse 1 of 2 Kings 18, it says, "Now it came to pass in the third year of Hoshea, son of Elah, king of Israel, that Hezekiah, the son of Ahaz, king of Judah, began to reign. He was 25 years old when he began when he became king, and he reigned 29 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Abby, the daughter of Zechariah, and he did what was right in the sight of the Lord according to all that his father David had done. He removed the high places and broke the sacred pillars. He cut down the wood image and broke in pieces the bronze serpent that Moses had made. For until those days the children of Israel burned incense to it and called it Nehushtan. He trusted in the Lord God of Israel, so that after him was none like him among all the kings of Judah, nor who were before him. Amen. So here's this king, and he looks at his kingdom, and it's a wreck. In the military sense, they had no military. In fact, they were paying money to Syria to protect them as a people. They were defenseless. Anybody could have marched into Judah and defeated it, so they had to pay people not to attack them. Obviously, economically, they were distraught because their money was going to foreign powers for protection. And so economically, it was a dire time in the country of Judah. But it was the spiritual aspect that concerned Hezekiah the most. So when he comes to the throne, he doesn't say, hey, I got to get this military rebuilt. I got to get the army rebuilt so we can quit sending our money to others to not invade us. It's not the council of economic advisors that he primarily wants to sit down and say, now, how can we grow this economy? Rather, he sees the major issue as spiritual, and so his desire is to reform, to revive the spiritual life of the people. That's where he wants to start. And notice what he does. It says in verse 4 that when he begins to reign, he begins to remove the high places. It's the first thing that he does. The high places were probably temples built to foreign gods. They would build them in mountains, but they didn't necessarily build them in mountains. They would also build them in valleys, sometimes on elevated tracts of land. But these are the temples built to foreign gods. And Hezekiah says, we're going to remove those from the countryside. And then it says that he breaks the pillars. The pillars were no doubt the idols or images of gods put in the idols that people would worship before. And then it says that he tears down the wooden sticks, the wooden rods. Actually, in the Hebrew, it's the Ashtaroths. And Ashtaroth was a god of fertility in Judah. And again, when that time and in that culture, the greatest thing, the most desirous thing you could have or want if you were a woman, even if you were a man, in many ways, was a child. And so this fertility goddess was a place where many times people would come and pray. And there would be Ashtaroth poles located throughout the land where people could come and pray to Ashtaroth, the fertility god, to have mercy on them and to give them children. There was a lot of sexual immorality that happened around those poles. And so Hezekiah says, we've got to rid ourselves of idolatry. We've got to deal with the temples. We've got to deal with the statues. We've got to deal with the idols. We've got to deal with the Ashtaroth poles. We have to deal with the sins that we know that are existing among us. We need to put them away from us. We need to deal with these things that we know are a problem. We need to put them away. But then curiously, after dealing with the temples and the idols and the Ashtaroth poles, it says that Hezekiah also took down and destroyed the snake or the serpent of Moses. Now that's interesting. I mean, you can see the temples to idols, you can see the idolatry, you can see dealing with all of these things that everybody knows was sin. God said time and time again, don't have idols, so deal with the idols. You can understand that. But to tear down this serpent of Moses seems strange. I mean, the serpent had great history. It was an important piece of the culture of the Hebrew children. Its history goes back 700 years. When the children of Israel had left Egypt, they were in the wilderness. Near the end of their 40 years in the wilderness, which they wandered because they had been disobedient to God, in the 39th year, they'd reached a point when they broke. Bible says in Numbers 21:5 that they became discouraged. Literally in the Hebrew it says that they became shortened. Their days were shortened. And what that simply means is that they lost their long suffering. Their tempers became short. They became angry. They had no coping mechanisms within them anymore to deal with the wilderness that they were in. Lawrence of Arabia was in that part of the country where we believe that they wandered. And he said it was a sad and hopeless place. And so this is where they had been for 39 years, and they began to complain. They complained about God. They complained about Moses. They began to complain about the food because they're getting manna, and manna's great. Manna's chocolate on chocolate. It's an angel food of the day, Psalm 78:25 says. It's wonderful, but when you've eaten it for 39 years, you're tired of it. So they complained about the food. God looked down on all of their complaining, and he sent serpents into their midst that began to bite them and put the poison in them. And they began to cry out for help. And God told Moses, build a bronze serpent, put it on a stick, hold up the stick. And for those who look at the bronze serpent, they'll be saved. Their lives will be spared. Now, you look at all that and you say, wow, that is an overreaction by God for complaining. Well, first of all, complaining is terrible. It's awful. If you've been in a car for 6 hours with a six-year-old, you know complaining stinks. God had heard it for 39 years. He was tired of hearing it. But you say, well, that's still an overreaction to send in the snakes. But you have to understand that oftentimes God tries to get a point to us about what's going on inside of us by giving us a sign outside of us, because we don't always see what's in our heart. And so oftentimes he uses object lessons. When he wrestles with Jacob all night, that's an object lesson. He's trying to tell Jacob that there's a wrestling in his heart, that he has been wrestling with God his whole life, because Jacob believes everybody else is the problem and he's fighting everybody. But he wrestles with him. This stranger in the night wrestles with Jacob in Genesis. And why would God wrestle with a person when he could just smite him like that in the morning? He just taps his hip and he walks with a limp the rest of his life. Why wrestle with Jacob? Because he's trying outwardly to show him what's inwardly inside of him. God will do that throughout the Bible. And I think what God is doing with the serpent sending them in is to say, listen, you're complaining, your lack of gratitude, this thing going on inside of you. It's a poison. It's eating you alive. It's a snake inside, and the snakes sent outside demonstrate what's inside. But again, the cure is to look at the bronze snake that Moses has made, and as you focus on the bronze snake, the poison that has infected you begins to leave your body, begins to lose its power. By the way, that's an image of Jesus Christ, isn't it? That's John chapter 3. Jesus is lifted up. Jesus becomes the sin of the world. Jesus takes on all the poison of the world. And as we gaze upon that crucified Christ who has been poisoned with the sin of the world, the poison inside of us can be forgiven. It's an image of Christ. And so this was an important snake. After this incident, a snake comes down. It's there, and the question is, what do we do with this snake? I mean, it's important. It's an artifact. And Haddon Robinson preached on this many years ago, and he let his imagination take over. He said, you can see them standing around saying, well, we just can't throw this snake away. I mean, this is important, crafted by the hand of Moses, had power from God to fix the situation. And so somebody said, well, let's put it in styrofoam and take it with us. Put it in a wagon, we'll take it to the promised land. And so for 500 years, that snake was floating around all through the time of the judges. That snake's in somebody's attic. And then Solomon builds the temple. And it dawns on somebody, you know what would be nice? You know what would be nice? You know, remember that snake from the wilderness? That's an important snake. I mean, God used that snake. It was very important. The power of God was demonstrated in that snake. Let's dig that out of the attic. Let's stick it on a pole, and we'll put it out there in the temple courtyard. And so when parents come, for instance, and they bring their little girls, the little girls are going to say, "Hey, Daddy, what's up with the snake?" And then that would be a great opportunity to explain to your kids, "Hey, that's an important snake. Let me tell you about the wilderness. The people were complaining. They were terrible. They were no good. They were dirtbags. They're awful people. But then that snake was part of their salvation. And let me tell you about the snake." And that would be a good thing. Have the snake there. It would be an example of, you know, be a talking piece. It would be a lesson. But then something happened. People weren't just coming and talking about the snake anymore. It just wasn't there. But they began to burn incense to the snake. I don't know particularly why they would do something like that. It may be that someone would come and say, "You know, God healed a lot of snake bites with that snake. A lot of people who should have been dead were made alive because of that snake. And maybe God will do it again. Maybe we'll just come over here and pray, and the Lord will offer a little incense and say, 'Lord, you know what you did 700 years ago with that snake? Would you do that again for my wife who's sick? Would you do that with the snake? Would you?'" But they start to burn incense to the snake. And when Hezekiah becomes king, then he destroys the temples, and the idols, and the Asherah poles. But he also looked at the snake that people were burning incense to, and he says, "Oh, it's got to come down too." It says he took the snake down and he dashed it to pieces. I can't imagine that was a popular thing for him to do. I think Steve Jobs said, I saw a quote a couple of weeks ago, a couple of days ago, where Steve Jobs, the founder of Apple, said, "If you want to be popular, go sell ice cream. If you want to lead, lead. But if you want everybody to like you, don't lead, go sell ice cream." He said it shorter than that. I can't imagine that was popular for Hezekiah to do. I can't imagine that people said, "Wow, that's great. Take the priceless..." I don't know how much the snake is worth. How much would that snake go for today? I don't know. $500 million? I don't know. How much would a snake personally crafted by Moses go for in our culture today? It's expensive. It's a work of art. I don't know what it looked like, but it was a work of art. It had been used by God in the past. And I can imagine there might have been people circulating saying, "We'd rather have the snake than the king. Get rid of the king. Don't get rid of the snake." It's an unpopular thing for him to do, to break that snake. But Hezekiah said, if we're going to have revival, if we're going to see God working among us again in power, if we want revitalization, if we want the Spirit of God back in our midst, we just don't need to deal with the sins, but we have to deal with the things that are no longer functioning according to their purpose. That snake was not meant to be worshipped. That snake was not meant to be prayed for. That snake was put there as an example, as a remembrance. And when it ceased to be what it was purposed to be, it had to come down. Had to come down. Now, I just say this for you and I. Oftentimes, when we're looking for spiritual revitalization in our lives, we want to deal with the sins. What am I doing wrong? What is God saying I shouldn't do that I should do, or that I'm doing that I shouldn't do? And we get focused on the sins. And you should focus on the sins in your life and allow God to point those out and be repenting of those sins. The sins are important. But if you want revival, you've got to go the next step and deal with the things that might have been good. It might have been a good snake in your life, But it's not a good snake anymore because it's not operating according to the purpose that it was meant to operate in. The purpose has changed. And you have to deal with those things as well in your life. I have to deal with those things in my life. Churches have to do that. One of the things that the Church of God founders many, many, many years ago believed, when they looked around the religious life of the late 19th century, they saw a good snake that had gone bad, at least in their minds. They saw this issue of church membership. And church membership, I guess, can be a good snake. If it makes you more committed to the body, if standing up in front of the church and saying, I'm going to be a member and I'm going to sign this and I'm going to fulfill the membership covenant, I guess that could be a good thing. But when they looked at church membership, they saw church membership as a way to make non-Christians feel like they're Christians. Because people would say, you would ask somebody, are you a Christian? It's like, of course I'm a Christian. I attend First So-and-So Church. I'm a member of the church, which is not the same thing as being a member of Christ. It's not the same thing. And they looked at this thing that might have been, maybe it never was, but it might have been a good thing. And they said, listen, this is just a way for, in many cases, for people who are not Christians to feel like they're Christians. Church membership is taking the place of a relationship with Christ, and we need to kill it. And they did kill it. And you know what? I sort of agree with them. I was pastoring in North Carolina a few years ago, and we had an annual business meeting, and we got like 40% of our church out for an annual business meeting, which is great in the Church of God, if you haven't figured that out. I mean, 40%, that's great. Don't complain about that. But a guy came up to me, and he had recently started attending our church from another church, and he came up to me as people are getting seated, and he said, where's all the people at? And I'm thinking, this is pretty good for us. What do you mean, where are the people at? He said, well, in the church that I came from, he said, we would see people at the annual business meeting that we hadn't seen since the last annual business meeting. At the annual meetings, the place was packed. They were there to vote somebody out. And you can have that. You can have that. I mean, I don't attend this church. I don't believe in Christ, but I'm a member and I'm here to vote somebody out. I had a friend who was preaching in Kentucky, and he's standing at the back door, and an old-timer came up to him, and he looked at him and said, he said, you know, true fact, we got more church members in this county than we got people. And he was right. As people moved out of the county, none of the churches updated their books. They had more people on the books in the churches than they had people in the county. Be a good snake, I guess. Although I tend to think it never is a great snake. But they saw it as a good snake that went bad, that needed to be fixed. Programs in churches can be good snakes that go bad. You know, one of the things that we've been talking about a lot and that you're going to hear all through August until you're sick about hearing it is Celebration Place. We are launching Celebration Place the Tuesday after Labor Day. And it's going to be a big thing. Celebration Place is in connection with Celebrate Recovery, and we have some great leadership that have agreed to lead it. And Celebration Place is for kids who are primarily in households where there are addictions. And so I don't know of anybody who's really ministering, I don't know of any church that's really ministering to the kids in the families of addictive households. And you might call it pre-recovery, but we want to give these kids skills. We want to introduce them to Jesus, but we also, again, want to give them skills for having to live in these places, sometimes in difficult situations where they can't get out of them, and we want to minister to those kids. And you're going to hear about that all through August because we want to launch it. We want you to know about it. I think it's the best thing since sliced bread, and I like bread. All right. But it's a great thing. And it's been a burden of mine. It's been a burden of Pastor Ralph. But I think I can speak for Pastor Ralph and me. I think it's a great snake. It's great. I think we're going to see generational sins broken. I think we're going to see generational problems in families broken with this ministry. And I pray that that's what happens. But I know, as well as you do, that children's ministries can sometimes turn bad. And it just turns into babysitting. And sometimes it's more about the workers, and the workers get together, and it's more about the workers socializing than it is about the kids. And I don't know that, you know, Ralph and I won't be here in 20 years. Unless something happens. I don't know. But probably me more than you. But, neither one of us probably be here in 20 years. But we will say this. If Celebration Place ever becomes a babysitting center, kill it. It's not what it's meant to be. It's meant to help children cope in those households. It's meant to break generational sins. It's meant to take higher risk kids and introduce them to Jesus. If it ever becomes about babysitting, it's a good snake gone bad. Kill it. I love life groups. I think life groups are the best way to connect people to Jesus and each other in the church today. I think it does that better, and there might be something come along that will do it better in 5 years, and we'll look at that. But I think it is the best way to get people together to discuss the Bible, to discuss the sermon, to come together and to edify each other in a relaxed setting, in a home setting, where they're also fellowshipping. And our life groups, they're designed to meet for about an hour and a half to 2 hours, and I think they average meeting about 3 to 3.5 hours. They like each other. They get along. It connects people to the church. We've had multiple people say to me, we might not be in this church if it wasn't for a life group. It's an important thing. It's a good snake. But it can become a bad snake if it just builds cliques within the church. If the people in the life group turn inward and all they do is socialize with people in their life group, and that life group becomes a place to air dirty laundry within the church, and that life group becomes a center for launching influence within the church, it's turned into a bad snake, and you need to kill it. Kill it. Get rid of it. It's not functioning as it was meant to function. Get rid of it. It's a good snake gone bad. You see, churches who want to see revitalization, who want to see revival, it's not enough to deal with the sins. You need to deal with the things that are not functioning as they were intended to be. Churches ought to be places of edification, ministries, services ought to be places where people are edified, Jesus is glorified, people are energized. And if that's not right, what is happening in that ministry, do something about it. And if you can't do anything about it, for God's sake, kill it. It's a good snake gone bad. It can happen in my life and in your life. Good things in our lives can turn bad. And it may not even be quote-unquote a sin. But if you want revitalization, if you want the dryness out of your life, you're going to have to deal with them anyway. I remember some years ago, I started to work, and I started saving some money and started putting some money in IRAs. And, you know, I was in IRA about 2 months and figured that I could do better than the mutual fund managers. And so I began to manage my own money. And I was what Barney Fife calls a plunger, all right? Which means, you know, all my money I'd stick in one stock and let it ride. I didn't diversify. I read something by Warren Buffett that said, the only reason you would diversify is if you don't know which stocks are going up. Diversification is insurance against your own ignorance. And so it's like, I was smart. I'd been in there 2 months. I knew what was going on. And so you would buy a stock, and I'd check it about every 2 or 3 days. And then put more money in, and it got to the point where the Dow Jones Industrial Average was up on my computer at all times. When I walked by, I could see what the market was doing. And it got to the point where my mood was noticeably affected if the market was bad. Now, watching your money is a good thing. Investing is a good thing. But if your mood on an hour-by-hour basis is affected by your money, a good snake's gone bad. Good snake's gone bad. I mean, that's how addiction started. And most addictions are good snakes that I understand. I mean, you have surgery, you have some pain, they send you home with a bunch of pain pills. The only problem is when your prescription runs out, you're sort of liking the pain pill. You have postpartum depression, you have whatever, you get prescribed stuff, and then it's a good pill, it helps, until you keep using it after you should be better. And instead of dealing with any pain in your life, you keep taking the pill. I had some kidney stones a while back, and I told you about those. It was awful. God lets women get pregnant so they know how their husbands feel about kidney stone. And a terrible thing. And but anyway, I had these kidney stones, and they sent me home with some oxycodone. And I had them, you know, over about a 2.5 week period. I had 3 or 4. And man, I get it. Oxycodone is great. And I had a couple stuck in my dashboard. I had them stashed all over anywhere I was, because if the kidney stone hits, it's like, medicate now. Just pull over, medicate. And but I used them there for about 2.5 weeks. And a month later or so, I hurt my knee. It was doing something, I'm sure, I can't remember, but it had to be really masculine, like trying to kick the cat or something. And I twisted my knee. And it really hurt later in the day. I couldn't walk it off. And later in the day, I just had this crazy thought. Oh, I got something for that. And then I had a second thought, which was this. Oh, that's how it happens. That's how it happens. It's a good thing. It's a good thing. It helps. It's medicine. But the good can turn bad. And if you want to revitalize your inner life, you have to deal with the good that's gone bad. Relationships can start good and go bad. There's such a thing as emotional adultery. You know that, don't you? Emotional adultery is when you're having conversations with someone that you're not married to, although you're married, and you're talking about things you should only be talking about with your mate. That's emotional adultery. That is, you're talking to people about your wife. No other woman, if she's not a counselor, and maybe not even that, has anything she shouldn't be hearing about your wife, other than anything positive. She shouldn't be hearing about your marriage problem. She shouldn't know what you don't like about your wife. And so, but you can have these friendships that develop at work. And they're friendships, and friendships are good. It's nice to be on good terms with your co-workers. It's nice to be able to sit down at lunch and have pleasant conversations with people you work with. But those friendships, again, can turn bad. It gets too emotional. You're talking about too much in those relationships. One more. I'm about finished, by the way. Social media. You know what Facebook was invented for? It was invented to connect you to people that you wouldn't normally be connected to. And it's great at that. I'm connected to people from my past that I would never be connected to if I was still working with the Yellow Pages. You're able to connect, and you're able to message people. It is a convenience thing. You can connect with people quickly in ways that you could never connect otherwise. But social media was never meant to take the place of a social life. It wasn't. It was meant to help and expand a social life. It was never meant to take the place of a social life. It wasn't. And if it has become our social life, it is a good snake gone bad. I mean, listen, I was thinking the other day, you know, many reasons why people don't attend church like they used to. Even 10, 15 years ago. And I think one of the reasons is social media, because you used to have to go to church to know what was actually happening at church. You used to actually have to show up to know what was happening. But now, you know who's sick, you know who's mad, you know who hates the preacher, you know everybody's political views, you know everything about what goes on at church, and you don't even have to go. You can listen to the sermons and maybe even watch the sermons. You don't even have to show up anymore. You can just know. You can feel connected, but not be connected. I think it's part of the issue that we're facing here today. And listen, it's great, it's wonderful, but it's not meant to, again, take the place of taking walks, hearing the birds chirp, of having conversations, of drinking coffee with friends. It's not meant to take the place of all of that. When it does, it's a good thing gone bad. And listen, let me put it this way, because I've been on Facebook for 2 hours at a time. First of all, I think it's probably addicting to know everybody else's junk. Just is. Something inside of us that likes to gossip, and Facebook can really help with that. But here's what happens, and this is just me. I'm talking about spiritual vitality here. When you get on media, social media, for long periods of time, when you get off social media, at least me, you're emotionally drained, and you're not ready to pray, you're not ready to study the Word, and when you're on social media, you're not thinking about God. It spiritually drains you, or at least it does me. I can take a walk and hear the birds chirp and talk with God a little bit, and when I get back, I can have a cup of coffee and read my Bible. I'm not emotionally drained. But social media is addicting, and it will drain you spiritually so that you feel numb, so that your desire to live is sort of taken out. It will take you down as far as energy to a very low level. And if you're on it a lot, it will make you a person that doesn't have energy to do much of anything that's important in life. At least it will for me. If you want to be spiritually revived, spiritual revival depends on you addressing the sins in your life. It does. But it also depends on me and you looking at the things that once were good, but have now gone bad in our life. The job that's no longer a job, but now it's an identity for us. The hobby that's no longer just about fun, but it's become an addiction for us. The relationship that was a nice relationship, but has increasingly turned toxic. The good snakes that have gone bad also have to be dealt with for spiritual vitality to return in our life. Listen, you can be living all that you know is right. You can be living as far as you know above sin. There's nothing that has you bound in your life that you can put a finger on. But if you have toxic relationships that have gone bad in your life, your job is your identity, you're on social media, and that's increasing and taking the place of a social life, if there's these kinds of things happening, you're going to feel the drag spiritually on your heart and soul, and you're going to feel the presence of God as being far from you, and worship's not going to have a vitality in your life. You're not going to be vibrantly in the Word and praying. Those things are going to be diminished by the good snakes that have gone bad in your life. And oftentimes they're a blind spot because we're dealing with the idols. We're doing what Hezekiah did to begin with. We're trying to kill all this stuff, and we're not even looking at these things that are happening in our lives. But Jesus Christ can help us. Will you stand with me?